Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamrock here. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold, so please forgive the coughing in the background. But I want to welcome all of you to this, the first of the 2024 season teleseminars by Xampro. And just to share with you a little bit of insight as to how we conduct these, we typically ask for volunteers, excuse me, who have questions, concerns, issues regarding a case on the case list. How do they handle, how do they write down a particular complication, how do they defend a particular issue, this kind of thing. We encourage you, all of you, to submit these cases to us during the week and volunteer to be on the hot seat. We have one person tonight who's done that, and you will see I'm a very benign guy, and I'm not going to be like your examiners who will be very tough, and they need to be appropriately so, but we'll talk more about that later. But A, I'm a benign guy. I'm not going to intimidate you. I'm not going to belittle any of you. We want to keep this constructive, which we do. I've done this for probably over 15 years now. And perhaps most important of all, I will never, ever mention your last name. So you always remain anonymous. No one will know who you are. So even if you say something which you feel in retrospect might have been silly or not really correct, no one will know, and no one will know the difference. So that's how it is. It's not scripted. Whatever you folks submit is what we're going to discuss. I usually have 2 to 3 people volunteering every session. And I try to keep the sessions at about 45 minutes in duration, to keep it short and sweet so that it doesn't impact your lives in a negative way too much. So with that out the way, tonight we've only got one person. I've read the email that was sent to me from the office from this our first candidate, and it's a very appropriate and important issue. I'm very pleased you submitted it, but it's not going to take very long to discuss. So after we discuss this, I'm going to share with you folks just a few basic thoughts that you need to keep in mind as you collect cases and construct your case list. It's, in fact, let me back off for a second and just say this. The exam is divided into 3 one-hour sessions, 1 hour each for OB/GYN and office. Now, each of those one-hour sessions is further subdivided into 2 30-minute portions. 30 minutes in each of those 3 sections is dedicated to the case list. So, folks, what this means is 50% of your case list, 50% of your exam is based off of your case list. Now, in the example of the office section, you've got total choice as to what you put down. In OB and G1, you don't have that kind of a choice. You really are pretty much obligated to put down certain cases and leave others off. But in all 3 sections, you have total, almost total freedom to write the case up how you want to write it up. And what I will share with you over the course of these teleseminars, and those of you who come to our cases construction course, I will share with you how you can write up a case list in such a way as to entice, get the examiner to ask you the very question that you're looking for. You can write up a case list in a way that highlights your strengths and minimizes the likelihood of any of your weaknesses coming up in the exam. It's actually very easy to do. Excuse me, I'm sorry, folks. It's very easy to do, and I'm going to show you how to do this as we go along from teleseminar to teleseminar. So with that out the way, let's get straight on with the first case, the only case that we've got for tonight. Justin, are you there? What I've done, by the way, folks, I've muted everyone out. As we get closer to the exam, more and more people sign up and join us on the teleseminar, and we've had on many occasions way above 100 people on a case on a teleseminar. You can't have 100 people contributing and the background noise blaring. So I've muted everyone out except myself. And I hope Justin may not be muted out as well, since he would have received a different code. You folks all received a certain code. Justin would have received a separate code. So he's not muted out, hopefully, and we can hear him speak. So, Justin, are you there? Hello. Are you there, Justin?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Justin, thank you. I can hear you loud and clear. Thank you so much for joining and volunteering to be the first volunteer of the first teleseminar of the year. So thank you so much. So, Justin, I've got your case in front of me because I read the email this afternoon. But for everyone listening in, I want you just briefly describe the case. And to you, Justin, and to everyone listening in, you need to start practicing how to talk. It sounds so stupid, but you need to practice how to present your cases in a succinct and to-the-point fashion. If a candidate starts presenting a case with a lot of esoteric information that's not relevant to the problem, it doesn't inspire the examiner into thinking that you know exactly what's going on. So you've got to practice presenting your cases and, equally important, defending your decisions. And I encourage each and every one of you to do this in everything that you do between now and your exam. I used to remember in residency, and I used to be very fearful of M&Ms, and I'm sure that conjures up horrible feelings in each and every one of you, or most of you. None of us really like M&Ms, and some of them can be particularly malignant. But in truth, that is really excellent preparation for the oral board exam, because it forces you to defend your decisions. So I want to encourage you between now and the exam, practice presenting your cases and do so in a succinct and brief and to-the-point fashion, and also just be comfortable to defend your decisions. So I've put you on the spot there, Justin, but go ahead, present the case to us, and let's talk about it.
So this is a 44-year-old para 3 who was diagnosed with adenocarcinoma in situ. He underwent a cold knife cone biopsy, which had negative.
I've got to interrupt you. I can read what you wrote. Adenocarcinoma in situ of the cervix, okay? It's typically in our lingo, it is of the cervix, but it doesn't have to be. So I'm just going to add that for everyone listening up. We're talking about a case of adenocarcinoma in situ of the cervix. Sorry. Go ahead, Justin.
Yep. And so she underwent a cold knife cone biopsy and an ECC with negative margins. And she was referred to me for continued management. I took her for a robot-assisted total laparoscopic hysterectomy and a PSO and a cystoscopy. She was in the hospital for one night. There were no complications. Final pathology revealed a benign 101-gram uterus and normal ovaries and fallopian tubes. And I was interested in the question of, do we need to perform cystoscopy on all minimally invasive hysterectomies?
So first of all, thank you very much. That's great. The reason you submitted this case, what is the standard, shall we say, of what is the role of cystoscopy in these cases of minimally invasive hysterectomies? And that is a very important exam topic, and it's also a topic I will share with you that maybe 4 or 5 years ago, on two occasions, I think a year apart, there were MOC, maintenance of certification, which we'll talk more about later on in the year. There were two MOC articles on this very issue. Say, ABAR feels it's important enough that they want all OBGYNs to read these articles. If it's that important, you can bet your bottom dollar it's also important from an exam point of view. So this is very, very relevant issue. And I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. I've got a couple of other questions that I want to address with you. And folks, this is a seemingly simple, straightforward case. But I want you to get in the habit of questioning everything about a case. Try and look at your case not from your perspective, but from the examiner's perspective. And say to yourself, if I'm with the examiner and I was reading this case, what questions would I ask the candidate? So it's in that vein that I'm going to ask you a few questions, okay, Justin? So the first question I have is, you did a TLH on a BSNO on a 44-year-old para 4 woman, okay? Para 3, sorry. Was the BSNO necessary?
The self-injectomy, you know, I think it was an opportunistic self-injectomy.
I'm not arguing about the self-injectomy. I'm talking about the, mm-hmm. I should have been more specific. I'm talking about the bilateral oophorectomy aspect, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't 100% necessary, but the patient's preference was to have all of her gynecologic organs removed to decrease the chance of a second surgery in the future should any pathology arise from her ovaries.
What does removal of the ovaries, early removal of the ovaries do? I think they call it for all, what do they call it? All cause life risk. I can't remember the exact words. In other words, removing the ovaries at an early age, overall, taking into account all aspects of possible death due to X, Y, or Z, osteoporosis, for example, fracture of a hip, and a patient dying from an embolus, all this kind of thing, all cause death. what's the thinking of early bilateral ovarian removal with respect to all-cause death? Good idea or bad idea?
It slightly increases the risk of all-cause death.
Look, I've also got to tell you, folks, in the interest of complete transparency, I'm a generalist. I'm not a subspecialist. But that's my understanding as well. And I continue because it's been 25 years or so since I got passed my board, but we have been increasingly more and more conservative as time has gone by. And today, we're not recommending removing ovaries at even less than age 55 these days. Okay, so the fact that you've gone and removed it. 44-year-olds, both her ovaries, raises somewhat of a red flag. Now, Justin, I'm not trying to cause you any dis-ease, but there's a point I want to make. Did you feel that this might be an issue for you in the exam, or did it really not concern you that much? Be honest.
No, it's definitely something that... you know, I struggle with because the majority of my patients, you know, have similar feelings. Let's put it that way.
And okay.
BSNOs.
So we hit the nail on the head for you with this one case, because on each and every patient that you, Justin, as well as all of you listening in, who have a case like this, you can't just present it and move on to the next thing. The examiner is going to bring you back and say, why did you remove the ovaries on a 44-year-old? And so there are a couple of general principles that I want to bring out here. Perhaps the most important one is that throughout your exam, be it OBGYN on office, but particularly so on the GYN side, you have to stress conservatism throughout your management in terms of how you counsel, how you treat it, how you try to go first with more with less morbid treatments and only left the greater morbid treatments and surgery until the last option. You've got to promote conservatism throughout. Very, very important, okay? And the next thing, and this is true for many of you, you've got a similar case to what we're discussing now, and also in multiple other scenarios. Any time a patient has chosen or requested a more conservative option, let's say she wanted a hysterectomy for AUB or chronic pelvic pain, and all she had tried was non-steroidals, and she didn't want to try anything else. You know, you've barely scratched the surface in terms of conservative options that you could offer this patient before resorting to hysterectomy. So anytime you've got a situation, and I'm guessing that the vast majority of you listening in have at least one, if not several, cases like this on your cases, or certainly you will have by the time the end of June comes along. Anytime you've gone with a lesser conservative option, it's a reasonable question for the examiner to ask you, well, how did you counsel her that she chose the lesser conservative option? Okay? So in a case like this, Justin, you've got to be able to describe, how did you counsel her specifically regarding removal of the ovaries? And if you've faced with a question like that, just understand where the examiner is coming from. They want to see, did you counsel this person appropriately for this particular clinical scenario? And so what I want you to get in the habit of doing is to embellish slightly. I'm never, ever going to tell you to be dishonest in the exam. Never. It's inappropriate. You'll get caught out. You'll lose integrity. And it's a recipe for bad things. So I'm never going to tell you to be dishonest. But, you know, there's certain things, gray zones, you can certainly embellish a little bit. And so if you're faced with this kind of situation, one of counseling, and by the way, counseling is a very important question in the exam on any procedure that you might be doing. If you're asked about counseling, embellish slightly the more conservative options and minimize slightly the more aggressive option. And what you're trying to do is show the examiner, you're trying to push the candidate into a slightly more conservative direction. That's the impression you want to leave the examiner with. Does that make sense to you, Justin?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Good. Any questions so far?
No.
Justin, on your end, any questions?
No.
Okay. Okay, good. Now, another thing that the examiners can easily do, they can take this case and change it ever so slightly, and you've got to be ready for those kind of meta-related questions. So in that regard, I would ask you, I'd be totally comfortable to get you involved in a conversation. You did this as a minimally invasive procedure. So, Dr. Justin, I'm playing the role of examiner. Do you think it might have been better, as opposed to a minimally invasive procedure, to have done this case vaginally? She's a para 3, after all. There would have been a reasonable amount of dissensus. This could have been a fairly straightforward TVH. Wasn't a large uterus. Why did you not do this as a TVH? What would you say?
That's tough. I mean, the truth is that I'm not, you know, extremely facile with TVHs, and I'm more.
Okay, so you stop there for a second. You bring up a very good point, but I'm now sidetracking into oral exam technique issues. But let's just do that. When they give you an FACOG behind your name, they expect you to be able to do run-of-the-mill OB and GYN. If you can't do a C-section, they're not going to give you an FACOG, and I'm sure you would agree with that, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the hard truth is the same holds true for a TVH. Okay, so for that reason, you can't just say I don't do TVHs, because it's like saying to them in code language, don't give me my FACOG. You can't do that. But that being said, there is a way to present this, and I encourage you, all of you, to use this kind of thing when it comes to things like TVHs, which many of you may not have been doing, or vaginal breaches, or forceps, anything which you don't have that much familiarity with. Say the following. You know, in my residency, I unfortunately did not get to do too many TVHs. And as a result, my comfort level is I will do a TVH, but everything needs to be optimal. And then you've got a list about a dozen variables, parameters, that constitute an optimal TVH. Size of the uterus, dimensions, fibroids, location, size of fibroids, dissensus, water parity, previous issue of PID, endometriosis, previous surgery, length of the vagina, caliber of the vagina, infrapubic angle. All of these things come into play. Okay, so if everything is optimal, I will do a TVH. If there's anything that complicates this, then I tend to back off from doing a minimally invasive procedure. But what I am doing, I've told all my colleagues, my more senior colleagues, whenever they have a TVH, if they're willing to let me scrub in on it, the hope is that I will get to do more TVHs, I'll get more experience, and I'll be able to offer this to a wider range of my patients. How does that sound to you, Justin, if you're listening to this as the examiner?
Great.
Be honest.
Yeah,
You see how you can twist
it.
You can put. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it sounds like you're being honest, right? But you're also educated, you know, about what a TVH is and how to perform it, and
you're being safe.
You know, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Correct.
So
yeah.
So what I'm showing you folks is there's a way to turn a seemingly negative into a positive. And then you notice how, because it definitely comes up in the conversation, what are the issues that you take into account that make you decide between TVH, versus laparoscopic approach versus abdominal hyst for that matter, okay? So that's a very real question you can face as well. Okay, now, those are two biggies. Now we come to the question that you posed, and that is the role of cystoscopy. Now, this is may not be an issue for any and all of you, and it may the degree of the issue varies by how many hysterectomies you've got on your case list and what percentage of them had cystoscopies. The basic understanding, and this was controversial 5-10 years ago, but it seems, in my understanding, to be somewhat alleviated now. The recommendation goes along the following lines. If you have any concern regarding the integrity of the ureters or the bladder for that matter, if there's any concern, by all means, go ahead and do a cystoscopy. It's a simple, easy, straightforward procedure. Go ahead and do it. But it shouldn't be a routine part of the hysterectomy. So the bar for doing a cystoscopy can be particularly low, but it shouldn't be that every single patient gets it, okay? So that's the short answer to your question, Justin. Now, you can't take this one case in isolation. If you've got two laparoscopic hysts on your cases, and both of them have cystoscopies, that's 100% cystoscopy rate. That's far easier to defend than if you've got 7 or 8 laparoscopic hysterectomies on your case list with 7 or 8 cystoscopies. Because you can't, you know, one or two cases, you can say, you know, in this case, I did get close to the ureter. I was a little concerned when I was closing up the vault. You know, for one or two cases, it's easy to justify the cystoscopy. But once you start having 7, 8, 9 of them, it becomes a little bit harder. So I'm adding this because I know some of you listening in do have larger numbers of hysterectomies. And the percentage, you know, I review case lists, tons of cases every year. So I know what you folks are writing on average. And I know that a lot of you are putting down or are doing cystoscopy pretty much routinely. And if you're doing it routinely, if you've got even 3 or 4 such cases on your list, you can defend it very easily. If you've got more, I would suggest if you get in touch with me, and we'll talk about that later. Or I'll just mention it now. Just send an email to me, basically. Attention, Dr. Shamloff. Send it to info@examPro.com with your question, with your cases, and the issues of surrounding how many cases you've got on your list, and I'd be happy to take a look at that and get back to you. Give me your telephone number. I'll phone you back. So that's the basic principle. Justin, does that answer your question, or do you still have any follow-up questions on this issue?
The only question I would have is, what if it's routine kind of in your practice, like with all of your partners, to do it?
Okay, so you bring up some fantastic questions, very relevant. And a lot of people listening in have exactly the same situation. If I were in the exam, I would do the following. When the examiner asks you, I see you've done 5 laparoscopic hysterectomies. All of them were associated with a cystoscopy. Do you do this routinely? your response, my response would be something along the following lines. You know, I've asked myself the exact same question because I am not of the opinion that this is necessary across the board. I don't believe that cystoscopy should be done routinely. There needs to be an indication. It can be a very small indication, but there needs to be an indication. And the problem that I'm faced with is this is a policy of the practice, or this is a policy of the hospital, and I'm the most junior member of the practice, so my word doesn't carry that much weight in relation to my colleagues. But I do believe we're being a little over aggressive here, and I'm trying to raise the awareness of this issue, and it is my hope that over the next few years I will be able to convince the practice to change its policy on this matter. How does that sound to you, Justin?
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, you can be honest. You can say it stinks. I've got broad shoulders. No. I can take it. Okay.
No.
But
this is very helpful. This is, yeah.
Okay, good. The basic principle that drives my responses to all of your questions, I say your plural collectively, is, and you should keep this in mind, be open and honest. You've got nothing to hide. You can say all these things. You can say, this is why I'm practicing this way, because this is the practice policy. I don't agree with it for these reasons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You come across as open, honest, understanding the issues at hand, and with tremendous integrity. And it sounds good because it's the truth, okay? So I'm pleased you like it, Justin. Any other questions on this particular issue, Justin?
No, thank you.
Okay, all right, excellent. I've got another 10 minutes or so. I just want to go through a few basic, very, very basic issues that I want you to keep in mind as you collect cases and enter it into the computer. Number one, try with respect to office to collect a broad range of cases. You've got to collect a maximum of 2 cases in each category. Not every category has to have a case. Some categories will have 0 cases, some will have 1, and some will have 2. Any of those options are fine. If you're going to put 2 cases in the vaginal discharge section, for example, make sure the one is BV and the other is trichomonas. Don't put 2 cases of yeast infection, okay? Because the second one doesn't add anything of clinical substance to the first one. So the 3 principles you should keep in mind with respect to which cases you select for office, and that is they should revolve around subjects that you are comfortable to talk about, that it won't be boring to tears for the examiner to listen to. And when you look at it in the context of all your 40 cases, try as much as possible that it should, each case on your office section should add a new clinical dimension to the overall class of cases in your office section. Okay, that's point number one. Point number two. In fact, I'm just going to go off at a tangent for a moment. We'll talk much more about it in subsequent teleseminars, but don't be fearful of your complications. Okay? Complications is where you 99.9% of the time can do very well, and like I said, we'll go into more detail later, but don't be fearful of your complications. And while not meaning any harm to your patients, I hope all of you have some juicy complications like bowel injuries and bladder injuries, ureteric injuries, etc., DVTs, that kind of stuff. It's terrible in clinical practice, but it's pure gold from the exam point of view. So the message, don't fear your complications. Getting back to caseless construction issues, the part of being a good candidate is to make it as easy as possible for the examiner to examine you. So with that in mind, don't give them an essay to read to understand what a clinical case is all about. When you write up your case, be as word poor as you possibly can. Just only words that are absolutely critical put down. And if you can say something with three words and not four, then say it with three, okay? And be very careful. I will talk more in subsequent teleseminar sessions about what I call reverse engineering your case list. And you won't know what I'm talking about now, but it will fit very beautifully. Just to touch tangentially on this issue of reverse engineering, I encourage you to use words that will pique your examiner's curiosity. So, with that in mind, I would tell you, be comfortable to say, fail, consider, you've got a patient who goes for a hysterectomy for AUB or chronic pelvic pain. Right there, before you do hysterectomy, the thing before it, you say, failed conservative management. When the examiner reads that, you're actually piquing their curiosity. Many of you are thinking already, what does he mean by failed conservative management? And that's what the examiner's next question will be, and you're just waiting for that to be asked, and then, you know, you just rattle off the answers when they actually ask you. So be comfortable to use words that imply something did not go in a straightforward fashion. So, failed medical therapy, declined TOLAC. If you write down on paper, declined TOLAC, you've just increased dramatically the chances of being asked the following question. Well, if she declined TOLAC, how did you counsel her? And I'm guessing that's a question that most of us would be very comfortable to handle. So based on the way you write up your cases, can to a huge extent dictate the questions that you're asked. And folks, I can tell you, every year I get emails back from candidates because I review part of what we do at Exampro. We review case lists, and part of that case list review is we predict the questions you're likely to receive. And I can't tell you, every year I get candidates coming back to me and saying, Dr. Shamroth, they asked me every question they asked me, you had predicted. And it's not difficult. It's not like I've got some genius gene in me. Any of you can do it. You just got to think about these things. That's all. So you want to have a discussion on Depo-Lupron, for example, but you didn't use it in any given case this year. So right, on whatever case you felt it would have been appropriate or could have been considered, write down Depo-Lupron contraindicated or Depo-Lupron not feasible. Give a negative. It piques the curiosity and it begs the question, well, why was it not feasible? And that once you get asked that, you're into a discussion on Depo-Lupron. Okay? The one I love, and every single one of you have this on your case list, all of you, you don't put it down on paper, but in your OB section, you've all got Rh negative patients. why don't you write that down? If you don't write down Rh negative, there's no way you're going to get a conversation on IC immunization. But if you write it down, you immediately increase the possibility. And if you are fortunate enough to have a case where the mom is Rh negative, and for whatever reason, the patient did not get Rogam, for example, no prenatal care, the father of the baby was Rh negative, or she's already immune, she already has autoantibodies. All of those would be contraindications to giving Rogam. If you're fortunate to have a case like that, then you write Rh negative, and in the treatment column, you write Rogam not given with an exclamation mark. You put an exclamation mark down on your case list. Because if the examiner sees Rh negative, Rogam not given, there's only one question they can ask you, why not? And you can understand once that question has been posed to you, you've got your conversation on IC immunization. So now you're beginning to see this, what I call reverse engineering. If, in this instance, you want to talk about IC immunization, this is how to construct your case list in the reverse manner so as to get the question coming your way. And folks, it's actually very easy to do this. And I don't mean by all this reverse engineering to demean or belittle the examiners. Not at all. They're very, very intelligent people. They're respected and they are well-educated members of our fraternity. But they're human beings, and so they're subject to the same psychological, let's call it manipulations. That's somewhat of a mean-spirited word. But they're vulnerable to the same psychological inputs as you and I. So use it to your advantage. That's the only point I'm making. There is so much more that I can tell you, folks, but we're actually running out of time. Before we finish, I do have a favor to ask you. I always do it on the first session of the year, and I'll do it one or two more times during the year. Folks, it's going to take you 20 seconds. Can I please ask you all a favor? Right now, as you listen to me finish off this teleseminar, please can you send an email to info@examPro.com. I would ask you just to rate this teleseminar. It's very important to us to get feedback. So if you can rate it on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being lousy, 5 being excellent. If you want to add other additional constructive comments, we'd love it. We'd be happy to have them. But at the very least, can you just give us a number, 1 through 5, send it to info@examPro.com. Again, 1 being lousy, 5 being excellent. And just rate the teleseminar. We really would appreciate it. Again, that email address is info@examPro.com. All righty. Justin, you were on the hot seat today. Please be honest. What was it like? Did you feel it was worthwhile?
Definitely. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And the reason I always like to ask candidates, because I know a lot of you listening in are hesitant and you don't really want to expose yourself intellectually, so to speak. And so the general tendency is to shy away from this. But I encourage you not to do so. And you heard what Justin had to say. It was a very good experience. And I'm sure, because I know from previous years, all the time, we get great feedback. So I just want you to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Okay, folks, then we do this every 2 weeks. So the next one, the next teleseminar is going to be on the 18th of February. If you found this helpful, please tell your colleagues to come and join us. It's free. Free is good. And I encourage you folks also to submit questions so you can take the place of Justin in subsequent teleseminars. And we'd be happy to have you on board. So, folks, that is it. Thanks to Justin for volunteering. Thanks to all of you for joining. And we'll do this again in 2 weeks' time. That'll be the 18th of February. So till then, all the best, and we'll speak in 2 weeks. Thank you, and take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.